This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
I like that we're both South African. We can start speaking Afrikaans if we feel that we need to speak in code.
No, definitely, definitely.
Is jy gereed?
Ja, ek is definitief gereed. Yes, boss.
For those wanting to know what we just said, we just made a remark about Epstein. What are you going to chat to me about?
Look, obviously 9/11, but there's a lot of contention and competing theories and stuff out there, and I was around 24 when it happened, saw it happen, thought that, oh hell, there's something weird going on here. And then later on here in 2005, 2006, you started people coming out with a whole bunch of weird and wonderful theories and CGIs and no planes and controlled demolition, and it's not what the government told us. And yeah, basically just started looking into various aspects. Wasn't really too phased about it. And later on, with the 20th anniversary, I saw a video with American university students who were being asked, you know, but if they know what the big anniversary is that's coming the following weekend. And it was astounding to see how little American students know about one of the biggest terror attacks on American soil this century. And I was just amazed by it. And that basically rekindled my interest in 9/11. I ended up going onto debate forums with some of the preconceived ideas that I had. And the people made really, really good arguments for and against certain narratives. And I just then thought, okay, fine. I've seen the thermite aspects. I can remember the first time that I saw Richard Gage with his two cardboard cutouts talking about how the one top can't fall straight down through the bottom of the building. So something needed to help the rest of that building just disintegrate. Also saw some of the guys talking about buried nukes. There's this the Russian guy that had a 10-hour marathon where he was just saying, no, but we had buried nukes. And then there were other people like James Fetzer that you've had on your show who was talking about mini nukes. You've had Dr. Wood on, you've had Andrew Johnson on, you've had guys from Architects and Engineers for Truth on, Adam Eisenberg, who mentions that there was no plane. So there's a lot of competing theories, and even Adam Eisenberg, who was at the Pentagon, has people in the Truther movement argue with him and say, no, but there was a plane. So, and that's people who weren't even there. Adam didn't go into much of that when you had him on. But on other podcasts, he's mentioned his interactions with people like Richard Gage, David Chandler, and all of these guys, and how they basically say that he's a liar, even though he could prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that he was there.
I just want to make sure I'm following. So what you're saying is that there's the official story, which is very obviously bunk.
Yes.
But the majority of people still believe that. But then there's the sort of official, so to speak, alternative theory.
Yes.
That's dominating all alternative theories.
Yes.
Is that right?
That's correct. The main protagonists are architects for 9/11 truth. I tend to call them architects for an engineered truth. They are the controlled opposition, if you really want to call it that. And you really need to go back into the history of the establishment of the 9/11 truth and movement. Everything took shape around about in 2005. And this is what I'm going to basically show you, because what people need to do, and seeing that it's been 23 years and 18 years worth of to and fro between specific truther celebrities, if you want to call it that, in the 9/11 sphere, a lot of mudslinging, a lot of conjecture, a lot of half-truths, skewing of the information and everything. And I want to make that case that people just need to step back, forget about what they've been told to believe, and then actually go investigate it yourself. But unfortunately, it's a tedious and time-consuming thing to work through this person's paper and the counter paper. And again, when you get to the certain theories or evidence being presented or whatever, you only get a bunch of negative articles that are dated back in 2006, 2007. And this is something that I've now seen on Substack, where there's a resurgence in the, if you can call it, the debunking wars. There's a professor in the UK, David A. Hughes, that wrote a Substack article recently with in defense of Dr. Judy Wood. And then he got...
Yeah, he's coming onto my podcast.
Oh, okay, awesome. I've actually got a small little clip of him that I want to play in relation to geopolitics, 9/11, and then academia that's also a little bit corrupt. So we need to step back, look at the basic history of the formation of the Scholars for 9/11 Truth in 2005. It was started by Stephen E. Jones. He's a physicist and nuclear scientist. Professor James Fetzer that you had on. And then they basically roped in a whole bunch of academics. Andrew Johnson was also roped into Scholars for 9/11 Truth. Dr. Wood was also roped into it, and many others. And that's when the theories and the ideas were being thrown around, and then it became a huge mudslinging contest of who's right, who's wrong, what can be done, can it be thermite, can it be nukes, is it directed energy weapons? And Andrew Johnson is one of the guys. He wrote two books, 9/11 Finding the Truth and 9/11 Holding the Truth, that basically chronicled it. Because like everybody, and myself included, I initially saw Richard Gage's stuff, thought, okay, thermite, because they had these small little experiments showing it can cut steel and it makes a huge fire show. And then I heard about the nuke stuff. It wasn't really my cup of tea. And by 2012, I stumbled upon Dr. Judy Wood and what she presented. And she was talking about a whole bunch of different anomalies that just cannot be explained by any thermal or kinetic mechanism. And if you don't do a little bit of research with regards to cold fusion and all of that kind of stuff, the Hutchinson effect, RF weaponry, scalar waves, and all of that, then it's going to sound very sci-fi. And that's the main problem that people have. And especially if you've already basically made up your mind and you're not willing to revisit it. And this is something that we're seeing, especially now in the health truth movement now, where you've also got the various layers of truth. And Professor Hughes has also written a great article with regards to COVID and the various layers. So if you investigated COVID and you can see all the hogwash with all the academics fighting amongst one another, it's exactly the same that happened in 9/11. And with 9/11,
I see the same thing in virology also.
Yeah, in every field, and I'll show one or two videos with regards to Colonel Tommy Bearden. I'll introduce you to him shortly. What he says about the academics, and it's also interesting that David A. Hughes is also making that point, and he basically says that academia is corrupted, and he's actually leaving academia now, and will only be focusing full time on his Substack and stuff. So I think we need to jump into some of the information that I can share. Just come into this with an open mind. Just forget about everything that you think you know, what you've been told to see or whatever, and just listen. It might pique your interest to go read a little bit more on all the information that I'm going to be sharing with
you. Well, let's do it.
Now, this is experiments and observations on electricity done in 1751, made at Philadelphia in America by Benjamin Franklin, and communicated in several letters to Mr. P. Collison of London, FRS. This is the fourth letter. And interesting what they said with regards to electricity, and something that he noted, and this is in points 54 and 53. So he basically says, metals are often melted by lightning, though perhaps not from heat in the lightning, nor altogether from the agitated fire in the metals. For as whatever body can insinuate itself between the particles of metal and overcome the attraction by which cohere as sundry menstrua can, will make the solid become a fluid as well as fire, yet without heating it. So how do you make a metal liquid without heating it? And that is things that John Hutchinson has done in the 1970s, and the US military really looked into it. So the electrical fire or lightning creating a violent repulsion between the particles of the metal as it passes through, the metal is fused. So if you would, by a violent fire, melt off the end of a nail, which is half driven into a door, the heat given to the whole nail before a part would melt must burn the board it sticks in. And the melted part would burn the floor if it dropped on. But if a sword can be melted in a scabbard and money in a man's pocket by lightning without burning either, it must be a cold fusion. So there was a huge hoo-ha in 1989 with regards to cold fusion. And Stephen E. Jones is one of the gentlemen that basically said it wasn't possible. And it was also very strange that he then ended up coming into the 9/11 truth and movement, but we'll get into that in a bit. So this is just something with Tom Bearden. Tom Bearden is a nuclear engineer, war games analyst, a military tactician, a lieutenant colonel retired. He had over 24 years experience in air defense systems, tactics and operations, technical intelligence, nuclear weapons employment, computerized war games, and military system requirements. Now, he dabbled in a little bit of free energy, and he also looked into cold fusion. And this is a very contentious issue because it's basically new physics. And you've got to just give a listen to what he has to say with regards to academia. And this is somewhere, I think, in the 1990s that he was making these claims.
Cold fusion. There's real stuff in cold fusion. You know, 600 experiments worked, for goodness sake. So the thing is, you're against the scientific community is against you, lock, stock, and barrel. And by the way, everything is a distribution curve. Get off of this horse pucky about scientists are always sweet, nice, reasonable people. That is not true. 10% of them are devils. 10% of them are angels, ought to be rewarded at the salt of the earth. But 10% of them have absolutely no ethics. Absolutely playing nothing but the big monkey and power game, and absolutely your worst enemy in this area. Glorious opportunity to, in other words, the vultures, or there's a better word for it, the wolves go around looking for the rabbits, and you're the rabbit and they're the wolf. So your next thing you get into is a big wolf-rabbit game with the scientists over on that 10%. So you face all of that. Meanwhile, you've got to go to the patent office. You get to the patent office, what are you looking at? This is impossible. This is perpetual motion. You say, well, the atoms have been doing this for 15 billion years. It's not perpetual motion, but it's just long lasting. But they call it perpetual motion. And of course, there is an unwritten law that anything that's perpetual motion shall not be even proved or looked at. You can't even get a serious consideration in the patent office. I speak as one who has submitted patents in this area. I know what I'm talking about. I've defended a couple of them. So what we have is a situation where the entire structure of science, industry, the organizations of science, and the patent office are already against you. If you can't get a patent, how can you license? So it's a real neat little thing. It's the old chicken and egg situation. If I had the chickens, I could get some eggs. If I had the eggs, I could get some chickens. This situation is designed so you never get chickens and you never get eggs. So the only thing you can do is to try to put your head down and continue with that and do one other thing, communication. Fortunately, we do have the internet. Sure, it's full of a lot of bad information. It's also full of a lot of good information. You just have to discriminate. So the other thing you have to do to have any chance at all is communicate, 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 communicate. Which we do to the limit that we're legally able to do and not lose our patents.
So the next aspect that he also comes into is with regards to in 1985, there was a huge jump for people to start looking into exotic technologies and things like that. And he was on CNN in 1985 talking about RF weaponry, scalar waves, and the research that he was doing into that. He also did, obviously, a lot of research into free energy devices. And in 1985, they actually showed this on CNN. And then what I want to do is, and I just added in something with, pertaining to 9/11. So let's show you that real quick.
Bearden believes that these satellite photographs are of mysterious non-nuclear explosions near an uninhabited island in the East Siberian Sea, and that they are discharges from an RF weapon that uses intersecting energy beams called scalars.
In doing so, you can create, for example, either an electromagnetic explosion at a distance, or you can create an electromagnetic implosion at a distance, the extraction of energy from a distant point. This would look like a cold explosion, so to speak. Or you can create an electromagnetic implosion at a distance, the extraction of energy from a distant point. This would look like a cold explosion, so to speak. This would look like a cold explosion, so to speak.
Now, the spire that you see over there is around about 900 feet in the middle picture. And that whole, that solid metal that all of a sudden just goes down in, I don't think that went down into 900 feet hole. And you actually had 16 people survive at the bottom of that column of steel. Now, when it comes to exotic technologies and all of that, in 1951, you had the Invention Secrecy Act. Now, the main thing with the Invention Secrecy Act, what if a guy like in the 1990s, we had Stanley Meyer with his water-powered car, and he could drive from the east to the west coast of America with 22 gallons of water. The Pentagon was really, really interested in it, and he ended up getting what people think, the conspiracy theory goes that he was poisoned because he was meeting up with potential investors, took a sip of his cranberry juice, and then basically ran out and said, oh, I've been poisoned, and he basically keeled over and died. Here's a very interesting question that some gentleman asked pertaining to the Invention Secrecy Act.
You may even pause the video to want to Google this to say, this can't be right. In 1951, the U.S. enacted the Invention Secrecy Act. What is that? Allows the government to legally classify and keep certain inventions secret if deemed a threat to national economy or security. Huh? What could be a threat to national economy? If you're able to figure something out that's 220 miles per gallon, you think it affects the oil industry a little bit? Maybe. Inventions under a secrecy order cannot be discussed, exported, or sold outside of military channel. Violations of secrecy order can result in imprisonment for the inventor. Over 6,000 patents today are kept by the U.S. government in secret. They didn't allow the people to go out there and sell it. I wonder what those 6,000 patents are. A lot of people want to be like, when you become a president, I want to go to Area 51. A lot of us capitalists want to find out what these 6,000 patents are.
Wouldn't you want to have a car that can drive across the country on 22 gallons of water? Because that'll be great. Or a cold fusion reactor in your house, and you'll never have to pay for electricity again. So now let's go back to 9/11, so that you just have an idea of that information of technologies out there. Now, when it comes to 9/11, everybody's been know that the towers went down and the big hoo-ha about Building 7. But a lot of people don't know that 7 buildings were affected that day, and there were all major anomalies that you cannot explain due to any thermal or kinetic mechanism. This is Building 3, the Marriott Hotel, 22 stories, right next to the South and North Tower. Basically, when this building over here came down, all that was left was that little stub of the building, and actually 14 people survived in there. And as Dr. Wood basically mentions, and as you can see at the bottom, you've got all these people standing here, and it's basically in the street. Now, a lot of proponents out there will want to tell you, okay, but when the buildings were blasted apart, you had the metal and everything basically ejected up to 600 feet in all directions. But if you look at this picture and you observe the evidence, the rest of that building over there is gone. There's no rubble of this massive two towers lying around here anywhere. So where did all that rubble and all that material go? It's not there. And then you had Building 4 that was right next to the South Tower. From the previous picture, it's basically on the other side. And 75%, that's the outline of this building.
Norman, just hang on 1 second. When you said that all these buildings went down, they didn't all go down on the day, is that right?
No, they all basically, as soon as the dust cleared and you had a look to see what was left, that was the only part that was left of Building 3, this previous picture.
What I'm trying to establish is, did all of those buildings go down on the same day?
Yes.
Okay.
So you had the two towers that basically disintegrated. You had Building 7 that fell at 20 minutes past 5 late on the afternoon. And we'll go through the massive anomalies with Building 7 as well. But as soon as the dust cleared and people looked around, all that was left of Building 3 was that little stump. And there's no huge amounts of rubble laying around anywhere. Now, if you go and do a little bit of research on a conventional controlled demolition using explosives, whatever, you will always have at least, on average, a 12.5% of the original building height for a rubble pile. So if you do your calculation on 12.5% on a 110-story building, you expect around about 13.5 to 14 stories of rubble that's supposed to be there. And if you look at some of the pictures, it's not there. If you look at the pictures of the World Trade Center complex, you basically had the Liberty Plaza sphere in the middle of the plaza. And even that sphere wasn't even buried under any rubble whatsoever. Now, returning to Building 4. Building 4 was right next to the South Tower. And in the background over there, you can see that is the Bankers Trust. So that's the 8th building that was affected, and we'll get to that in a bit. But this whole section of this building disappeared. So if you think back of the videos that you've seen with the South Tower was the first tower that went down, and it basically had the top part that slightly twisted, and it looked like it was going to fall over. Now, if that top part of the building fell down all the way to the ground, it would have crushed Building 4 that you've got in front of you, but it didn't. When the dust cleared, that section of the building was gone. Not there anymore. Nothing fell on it. That section of that building disappeared. And underneath the whole World Trade Center complex, you had basements of car parks, and there was a huge shopping center there as well. The basement underneath that was mostly not damaged. There was this cover story saying, oh, but everything fell down into the basements. But if you listen to firemen testimonies and everything, and specials done by 60 Minutes and CNN when they went into the basements in around about October, November that year, they basically saw that the trains and everything in the bottom of it was still intact. The phrasing that the guys actually had is the deeper they went, the more intact it was. And the one gentleman also made the comment that most of the vehicles that were parked in the parking garages were driven out from where they were. And that is very, very, very telling. That just means that whatever made up those 500,000-ton buildings never hit the ground. It never went into the basements. There was some damage here and there, yes, but mostly intact. Now, this is Building 5, and it had some weird and wonderful circular holes in it. You can't really find a lot of information pertaining to Building 5, and this is really, really, really strange. Number one, in the back over there, that is what was left of Building 7. If you look closely over there, it didn't even spill over. I think that's the post office. It didn't even spill over onto the sidewalk there. And there's another anomaly. Once again, if you do the calculation of 12.5% of a 47-story building, that rubble pile was only 3 stories, where it should have been around about 6 or 7. So once again, a lack of rubble. But we'll get into Building 7 a little bit later. But what you've got to look at, this is Building 6. And right over here is the North Tower that went down second. And if you look at this small little section here, that is Stairwell B. 16 people survived there. Another gentleman with the name of Pascal Buscelli, I'm just getting the name wrong. He was coming down from the 84th floor, and by the time he hit the 22nd floor, he started hearing the major rumbling and the shaking of the building, and he basically fell down in the stairwell and just curled up as small as he could make himself. And then the next moment, he felt himself falling through the air. And he ended up landing on a perch in that broken down piece of rubble. And his statement was, as soon as the dust cleared and he looked up, he saw blue sky. And this really freaked him out for a whole number of years. Didn't really talk about it that much. And I think in 2022, he really started doing interviews, and maybe a couple of years further. So you can actually go onto YouTube and just search for the 9/11 surfer or 9/11 miracle man that they call him. Because he had a 500,000-ton building above him. The building starts rumbling. He basically mentioned it was the sound was like a freight train coming at him. And the people that were with him, instead where he was jumped down the stairs a bit, the other people who were with him ran into the 22nd floor. And they never made it out. And the same with the 14 first responders as well. Mickey Rourke is another gentleman who basically just said that he couldn't believe it. He thought that they would be buried forever. And whilst he was laying there with all the darkness and soot and dust going around, all of a sudden he saw sunshine coming through. Now, that's freaky. So these guys weren't blasted to bits by explosives. They didn't have thermite raining down upon them from above. They didn't die from radiation poisoning from some sort of nuke going off. There was a 500,000-ton building above them that just disappeared. And if you look at Building 6, a lot of people would say, oh, okay, fine, the big hole in there is due to rubble from the North Tower that fell into it. But if you look at the other pictures available, that inside of that hole over there is empty. And it's crazy for people to think about this, but that inside of that building basically just disappeared as well. It's sci-fi. It's really, really sci-fi. And a bunch of people can't just get their minds around it. And then when you go onto Building 7, there's a major anomaly that people never talk about. Okay, the official story is it went down to fire. Then what everybody else says is, okay, fine, when that building came down, it looks like a controlled demolition. But when you have a controlled demolition, you've got a certain amount of rubble, and you also have seismic readings that you can take. And this is the main anomalies that Dr. Wood has also mentioned, and she also mentioned to you in her talk, is the seismic readings weren't in line for the weight of the buildings, especially Building 7, because it fell down without a primary wave or a secondary wave. They only had surface waves. Now, what does it mean if you've got a surface wave? It's like when you go and sit on a bed and you've got these old springs still. If somebody stands up, you can feel that movement in it, and that's exactly the same with the conductivity of the seismic readings in the ground. And Building 7 only left a 0.6. Now, Dr. Wood compares that to the Seattle Kingdome, and that building was 130,000 tons, and then Building 7 was 230,000 tons. That 130,000-ton Seattle Kingdome left a 2.3. Building 7 left a 0.6. And the seismic readings never get talked about because the people in the Truth Movement cannot explain the lack of the seismic readings. Even the two 500,000-ton buildings going down should have at least registered a 3.5, 3.7, and they were at a 2.1 and a 2.3. So that's strange. You can't explain that due to thermal or kinetic mechanisms or even nukes going off, because if a nuke went off that was buried somewhere, you would see that on the seismographs. So again, something very strange. Survivors, what do we know about them? 500,000 tons of a solid building material did not collapse down on top of them. If it had, they would have been crushed and buried by it. They were not blasted or deafened by explosives or hit by shrapnel. They suffered no burns from jet fuel, fires, lasers, molten metal, pyroclastic clouds or nukes. They were not struck by a single falling steel beam or other fatally heavy objects. They were not vaporized or blinded by nuclear detonations. They did not see, feel, smell any molten metal coming down from the floors above. And then we've got the Bankers Trust building that was across the street from Building 4. It had a huge gash in it from some of the steel beams falling on top of the building. They spent millions of dollars to repair it, but for another reason, they then found that there was some sort of effect to the metal and it was degrading and it wasn't safe for them to keep it up. And they then had to dismantle that building. People don't know about that either. So in the Truther movement, your attention is put onto the towers in Building 7. For the last 8 years, the only thing that Architects for Engineer Truth were talking about was Building 7. But they never talk about Buildings 3, 4, 5, 6, or the Bankers Trust building. Why is that? Because it doesn't fit the narrative. And nobody can explain those anomalies except Dr. Wood. Even when you had Fetzer on, when you asked him about Building 6, he got all flustered and angry. That should make you ask questions. Now, a lot of people have gone out and they've given Dr. Wood a bad name. And once again, a lot of people don't even know who she is, what she's about. If you want to research her, you only see smear and ad hominem attacks about her. And you need to know who this lady is and why she is qualified to be able to talk about things like this, because she talks about so many aspects that other people just aren't touching on. So I just want to give people a little bit of an introduction to Dr. Wood before we go into the history of all the infighting that's happened since 2005.
Dr. Judy D. Wood is a former professor of mechanical engineering with research interests in experimental stress analysis, structural mechanics, optical methods, deformation analysis, and the materials characterization of biomaterials and composite materials. She's a member of the Society for Experimental Mechanics, SEM, co-founded SEM's Biological Systems and Materials Division. She has served on the SEM Composite Materials Technical Division. She received her Bachelor of Science in Civil Engineering in 1981 in Structural Engineering. Her master's degree in engineering mechanics in applied physics in 1983, and her PhD in materials engineering science in 1992. She has published more than 60 technical articles in various publications, in refereed journals, in conference proceedings, and edited monographs and special technical reports. She has conducted a comprehensive forensic investigation of what physically happened to the World Trade Center site on 9/11/2001. In 2007, she filed a federal case for science fraud against the contractors who contributed to the official National Institute of Standards and Technology, short NIST, report about the destruction of the World Trade Center towers. This case was filed in the U.S. Supreme Court in December 2009. Her book titled, Where Did the Towers Go?, is the only comprehensive forensic investigation on this topic in the public domain.
The main thing is, in 2023, obviously 2022, I ended up going into all these debates, debate groups and everything. And eventually they then ban you when you can basically show that all the talking points that they are bringing up is a diversion of the truth or partially false. I also ended up getting into Zoom calls with a lot of the 9/11 truther talking heads. And then I specifically asked them about the court case of Dr. Wood. And there was another gentleman, Dr. Morgan Reynolds, who also sued NIST in 2007. But he took them on with a fraudulent plane impact studies that the guys did. But if you ask Richard Gage about this, he plays dumb as if he doesn't know about this. There's another organization that was founded in 2023 called the International Center for 9/11 Justice. One of the other guests that you've had on, Piers Robinson, who's got Propaganda and Focus and all of that, he's also part of that institution. And Ted Walter is the main guy doing all the interviews. And if you ask him about it, he also hasn't heard about this. And if you're in the truth movement, there is information here that you guys aren't talking about. You're not talking about the 9/11 orphans. You're not talking about the weird cars. You're not really they're not really talking about the airplanes and some of the anomalies there, which Mark Conlon, who you had on, has made some really, really good information. So the main things that we are sitting with As we mentioned, we've got the three main narratives, the official government conspiracy theory, the alternative propaganda theory. These guys basically say that we had the hijackers, the planes were taken under remote control. And this is something that we've seen now in 2024, where the main push is to bring that narrative back into the public sphere. And that really happened after you had Mark Conlon on. This International Center for 9/11 Justice, I call it Justice Suppressionist, they had a huge hoo-ha of a series where they had a bunch of panelists on there talking about the planes, but they didn't talk about the basic plane physics. And I would say anybody who's interested in 9/11 and want to know about basic plane physics and the issues with that and some of the anomalies, they need to listen to your interview with Mark Conlon, because the physics just doesn't match for planes. And this is a major, major mental hurdle for people to get over, because they saw the videos of the planes, but they did see planes in the sky, but it wasn't solid planes. So let's get back to the third narrative, and this is the Dr. Wood's narrative. If you really do your homework and look into everything, then you'll see the real version is backed by actual evidence, laws of physics, and common sense. There were no hijackings, no plane crashes in the World Trade Center complex, not just the towers in World Trade Center 7 was destroyed by directed energy weapons, and the government and the media steer clear of these. So I want to just go down to the start of all of these issues, with the formation of the Scholars for 9/11 Truth under the auspices of Professor James Fetzer and Stephen E. Jones. So let's just get a quick introduction to that and a bit of an idea of what's transpired since 2005.
In 2005, Jim Fetzer, Professor Emeritus from the University of Minnesota and noted JFK assassination researcher, teamed up with BYU nuclear physicist Stephen Jones to create the Scholars for 9/11 Truth.
So I'm very, very troubled to have been forced to that conclusion that the man I made the co-chair of Scholars for 9/11 Truth when I founded it in December of 2005 actually was an expert in promoting what I regard as a limited hangout, the nanothermite theory, which, as I've explained, cannot possibly explain the data. In fact, just to illustrate its absurdity, Niels Harrod, who was an associate professor at the University of Chemistry at the University of Copenhagen, emeritus, when asked how much nanothermite it would take to destroy a twin tower, he said, 29,000 metric tons. 29,000 metric tons of nanothermite to destroy a tower, Joe. I mean, how absurd is that?
Yes, on their misinformation publication that they put out with one of their DVDs, the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth said that it takes 0.13 pounds of thermite to melt each pound of steel. Well, if you're missing 100,000 pounds of steel, tons of steel, how many tons of thermite? Exactly. Yeah, that they've absolutely proven themselves to be relaying false information if they can't even do the basic physics involved in that calculation.
The truth movement won't even discuss the airplanes. The interesting thing is, a lot of people controlling the truth movement know all about this technology, and they're actively trying to cover it up.
Give us your background, some of the publications you've written for.
Sure. Los Alamos National Lab. The article is Cold Nuclear Fusion. I'm the principal investigator for the Department of Energy.
Amazing. So you've headed up investigations for the government before.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've been around the block a few times.
So Jones, I think, knew about all of those effects and was briefed on some of them as well, if he didn't already know. I'm pretty sure of that.
The cold fusion part of it. In fact, that was the title Paul Palmer and I gave to what we were doing, which is, we sometimes called it metal catalyzed fusion, because the fusion occurs in metals. Fusion occurs in metals and metals and metals.
Essentially, the only way to muddy the waters is just to insert doubt at every possible opportunity. And there are some very sort of common techniques, you know, which I think I put them all under the umbrella of perception management, whereby instead of using the word evidence, you never use the word evidence, you use the word theory. And this then, you know, immediately changes the, mischaracterizes it so that a theory, of course, can be debated, you know, much to a much greater extent than evidence.
There's a whole lot of evidence and very weird things that happen at the World Trade Center. We don't want every theory out there on our website. There's a whole lot of evidence, theory, evidence, theory, evidence, theory, evidence. I'm not going to present every piece of evidence out there that I can't explain.
When you look at 7, that's a conventional controlled demolition.
No, it isn't. No, it was not either. Because you got to read the book, Where Did the Towers Go? By Dr. Judy Wood, BS, MS, and PhD.
No, I know who she is. I know who she is.
I just finished her book. It's very remarkable.
That's the issue there. Alex Jones has been asked by numerous people through the years to actually have her on and have a conversation with her, and he just completely just doesn't want to. So
why do you think that is?
Well, I don't know. There was such a massive campaign put out against her with the start of the truth movement. It's weird. But when people ask him about it, he just doesn't want to go there. He's also pushing the nanothermite aspect of it as well. So if we go back up to the top, and this is a lengthy article that basically chronicles the time frame of the truth movement since 2005. Now, a couple of things that people need to keep in mind. They'll remember former Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta. He was the guy that testified and talked about Cheney's stand-down order for the plane coming into the Pentagon. But something that people don't know is he was the vice president of Lockheed Martin, the sponsor of the Directed Energy Professional Society. Mineta ensured the minimum interference with the DOE by grounding as many commercial airliners as possible during the time frame of the tower's destruction. And when you look at Stephen E. Jones, he's a former BUI physicist professor that worked at Los Alamos Labs where directed energy weapons were being researched. And he was the guy who talking about the thermoconventional explosives molten metal theories. But it's been shown that his molten metal evidence has been fabricated, and we'll get into a short little 2020 physics debate between Denny Rancourt in 2020, where he basically proved that Jones's initial thermite paper was based on flawed science. Then when you go into any type of debate with regards to the directed energy evidence, you will always find a video where this Dr. Greg Jenkins had an interview with Dr. Wood, and that was basically used to defame her as well. Interesting thing about this, he's got connections to the NSA and DOE as well. And he's currently is an experimental associate research scientist in the physics department at the University of Maryland, College Park, for nanophysics and advanced materials. And he studies electronic properties of condensed matter systems. So again, a guy who's in that field trying to discredit her early on in 2007, and then he just disappears off the 9/11 truther movement. Now, this is I'm going to play just a 2-minute short clip of this whole ambush interview that he had with her. Dr. Wood was actually attending a talk that was given by James Fetzer on her work and Dr. Morgan Reynolds' work. She was just in the audience. And then all of a sudden, this Greg Jenkins guy pops up with two cameramen, professional audio lighting equipment, and they basically caught her when she was quickly going to the bathroom and said, no, but we want to have a quick 2 to 3 minute interview with you. And it was a bit of a shit show. So if you go into this article of mine, there's a whole article giving you the background information on this whole ambush. But I just want to point out two things, and you can tell me if this guy is sincere or not.
This is not productive. It's not educational.
It's educational for me.
What's the subject now? Is it steel? Is it concrete? Or is it dust?
You choose, please.
This is a game you're playing.
I'm really not playing a game.
Did you figure it out? The answer is a biological process called Duper's Delight. If you don't know what Duper's Delight is, it's the rush of endorphins a liar gets when they lie and get away with it. This can make them act giddy, cocky, or carefree.
I'm just trying to figure out what it is you had on your website. I'm just asking questions regarding...
What is your question? Ask the question, and we stay on that subject through the whole sentence.
Through the whole sentence. Mm-hmm.
See if you can handle that.
Okay, I'll see if I can handle that.
He was definitely being disingenuous.
So then there was another gentleman who came out rather early on the 9/11 aspect, and his name is Van Romero, and he's the guy who basically interjected the whole idea of controlled demolition and explosives. And I think, yeah, he gave an interview basically a day or two after 9/11. And this gentleman was an official at the New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology. He's also got ties to the Directed Energy Professional Society. At DEPS, he actually gave talks. So just to have a listen to what Dr. Wood mentions about him.
On the afternoon of 9/11, Van Romero from New Mexico Tech spoke out in some interview he did saying that, obviously that was controlled demolition. You know, I could just tell. It would take a few bombs to do it. And then 5 days later, as the story goes, 5 days later he retracted it. And then he got $80 million in grant money from the government. And so then the truthers say, that's proof he got paid off. But it turns out that a year before 9/11, he taught a short course at the Directed Energy Professional Society in energy weapons.
Oh.
He knew what he was looking at. Well, like also the first time that Stephen Jones went on Tucker Carlson's show, first of all, how did he, how was he chosen to do that? But anyway, he was on there, and this big deal was made about how they wouldn't play his video of Building 7, so therefore it's important.
Huh.
And it was sold to us. It's sort of, a kind of a reverse psychology type thing, like force feeding a dog. People want what they can't have. So it brought greater interest to it.
I think what becomes difficult to comprehend, one of the problems is that the cover-up is so enormous. And when you say things, for example, like, you look at a similar comment with Larry Silverstein and the Pullet, mm-hmm. The Pullet comment.
Yeah.
And to think that he would have made that comment to, stir up people in the truth movement, that doesn't make a lot of sense to people. They just can't believe that you would actually, in other words, you would actually engineer the cover-up to take in the people who are already questioning the official story. They don't see the second and third and fourth layer of this. It's just beyond, the sort of level of comprehension. And then you've got people like Alex Jones promoting that clip, and I was taken in by it as well, so I can speak from direct experience, because I believe, as I've said many times when I've done talks like this with folks, I was taken in by the bomb story. When I started to look at stuff, I didn't believe the official story, but I was taken in probably for at least 2 years by the bomb story, and it took me quite a long time to kind of cure myself of that, I suppose, in one way of putting it.
So that just shows you that there's a lot of cloaks and dagger and backstabbing happening with regards to everybody. So I would suggest people go through this article because it breaks it down very, very nicely for you. So at the end of the day, you had certain people who were getting onto mainstream media, who were pushing certain narratives that was the approved counter-narrative to the official government conspiracy theory. And that's where people get caught and they don't go into it any further. So that's classical perception management of people. And don't you dare look at that other woman's work that she's brought up, because it's absolute sci-fi and you're going to be part of a cult if you follow her. And that's exactly what James Fetzer did in his presentation that he had with you. And the strange thing is he was a proponent of her work, and he would introduce her as the best person to listen to, who's got the best qualifications for this. And that's strange.
So what do you think happened there? Also got paid.
he might have been threatened. Who knows? There was another gentleman in 2006 that came out. His name was Dean Warwick, and he was talking about the same type of technologies that he saw in the 1950s and the early 60s with the British, the Soviets, and the Americans that were busy dustifying 25-story buildings. And he went onto a radio show, talked about all of this, and he was in MI5 or MI6. And around about 2 months later, he ended up doing a presentation. And whilst he was doing the presentation in the auditorium, he mentioned that he felt a strange bit of heat against his head. And a couple of minutes later, he keeled over and died. And the people who were there saw a person get up, walk out, all happy-go-lucky, singing a song and getting into a car on his cell phone and having a huge laugh. Now, if you go back to Jesse Ventura and his conspiracy documentary series or TV series that he had around about, I think, between 2011 and 2012, they were talking about heart attack technology, directed energy guns that can shoot you and make you die of a heart attack. Because what this gentleman wanted to do is he wanted to talk about who killed Bobby Kennedy. So that's just strange. The guy was 100% fine. A month previous, he was talking about directed energy weapons. Even David Icke, in his 2002 book, basically wrote about it possibly being directed energy weapons. And he had a personal interview with Andrew Johnson. Andrew Johnson gave him Dr. Wood's book. David Icke was actually selling her book off his website. And then around about in 2007 as well, he just changed his tune, started talking about controlled demolitions and all of that. Exactly the same with Ken O'Keefe. I actually interacted with him on X. Andrew Johnson also saw him. He read Dr. Wood's book. He's got a copy of Dr. Wood's book. He actually mentions, yes, it was justified by directed energy weapons as well. But he goes on this whole Israel tirade, but how about just calling out the U.S. military for covering up what happened at the World Trade Center complex? So there's a lot of innuendos and a lot of people just covering stuff up. I want to just play this little section with regards to the molten metal aspect that's been debunked. There's a huge talking point of, oh, the rubble pile was warm and or hot, thousands of degrees, and the guy's boots were melting, but we haven't ever seen any of these pictures. And this is when Jesse Ventura basically ended up reading Dr. Wood's book, and he was interviewed by Alex Jones. And this was in 2012. Then I'm splicing in some information where I was talking to some of the 9/11 talking heads like Wayne Koster, Richard Gage, and all of those guys, where they basically debunk themselves in a Zoom call where I asked them about some of the molten metal aspects. So let's just quickly listen to this, and then we'll just run through the other stuff.
We have the videotapes. The firefighters reporting molten metal like a slurry or a steel mill or a volcano. Those are quotes. Giant pools.
What about the pictures of them dragging oxygen hoses all over the steaming supposed hot metal? If it were that hot, you wouldn't dare do that, would you?
That's a very good question. It's also one of the first times I've heard Alex Jones speechless.
But if you go through the photographs of people taking the towers apart, doing the cleanup, I know Richard's got the big book, 1,000 pictures, 500 pictures. During the cleanup, nobody reported seeing melted steel in these core columns. So we don't know when and where they were actually destroyed. And, you know, just like we don't know where the flight data recorders went to that they were reported, you know, maybe some things disappeared. And if so, we'll never know where those steel pieces might have been and what could have brought the core down.
There goes the second tower. Unfucking believable.
Well,
So just something to remember, underneath this spire of 900 feet, that's where the 16 people survived in stairwell B. Okay, so that was a solid structure that dropped down vertically onto the ground, but 16 people survived in the middle of all this carnage. And does that look like solid pieces of steel going down into the ground? I don't think so.
There's a whole lot of evidence and very weird things that happen at the World Trade Center. Okay, there are about 10,000 file cabinets that are missing. There's about 20,000 floor trusses and 220 acres of metal decking that's missing. The question is, where did it go?
And that's where the 16 survivors survived, in the North Tower. And this is the picture that they also used to say, oh, but this is proof that steel beams were cut. But this was actually done with thermitic lances during the cleanup. And this was in the pile. There's API pictures where you can see where the that piece of steel was still buried and how it was being cut as well. So the whole story with them showing you that picture is a blatant lie. And you can disprove that with official API pictures that were taken during the course of the cleanup. And you can see it's got exactly the same cutting slag on those beams. Just whilst we're on the thermite, I want to play this short clip where Denis Rancourt was talking about they basically discussing the dust in the rubble.
One statement you said was they found nanothermite. Well, no, they didn't. You know, if you read that paper, and I've criticized it as I would act as a reviewer for a material science paper, because I am a material scientist, and I've stated and explained why there is absolutely no reliable evidence of nanothermite presence in that dust based on the data that was reported in that paper. That is a paper that reviewers should have caught as just being untenable, that much more work was needed. And one of the main, just to give you one example of one of the fatal flaws in the paper, they analyzed for aluminum by putting dust on an aluminum holder, a pellet. You need a conducting pellet when you do these measurements in electron microanalysis. Well, they put a little bit of dust on an aluminum slug. You're always going to get an aluminum signal from that. There's no way to avoid it. And that's what they did. And when I pointed this out, they said, yeah, we know, but we're going to do it. We're going to do the measurements again on a different slug, on a non-aluminum slug. I said, great, send me the results when you get them. They never did it. So, you know, if you were to use one word regarding the results of that paper, it would be unreliable. And I'm being polite. The first author of the paper is not even a material scientist. He'd never used these characterization methods before. I taught these characterization methods at the graduate level at university for years. I know exactly what the artifacts are. They did all the things you should never do, and then they concluded something which you couldn't conclude based on their data, and then it became what everyone's talking about. So it's just not reliable at all. There's no evidence of nanothermite at all in the dust from that paper. Now, if in the recent year or two, they redid the measurements and they published it, I didn't see it. Well, that's something else. But the paper that everyone is citing and talking about, and that was even reviewed in the European Journal of Association Journal recently, a couple years ago, it's a nonsense paper. I'm sorry, but it's wrong. Normally would not have been published. Now, I'm fine with people publishing things on the internet and having it critiqued openly and so on, but normally using rigorous peer review, that paper would not have been published. In fact, two editors-in-chief of that publication resigned over that paper, two in a row. So, yeah, no, you can't say there was nanothermite there, in my opinion.
Yeah, that shows you with the problems in academia. And even when Dr. Wood was doing experiments with her assistant, Michael Zabur, proving that what Stephen E. Jones was presenting with aluminium that can't glow and everything, It's all in Andrew Johnson's book. It's on her website where all the correspondence is. You can go through it. And strangely enough, a short while after they did that, they did these experiments on the 28th of February, 2006. And by March, Michael Zabur was killed in a botched robbery. Other strange things that happened, we already went through Dr. Malov and his book of Fire and Ice. In that book, he basically mentions Stephen E. Jones over 300 times with regards to the cover-up of Cold Fusion. He was also killed at his home. And later on, when Dr. Wood basically just submitted her request for correction to NIST in 2007 and started doing her QTAM case, there was a shooting at her university. Also, when Jones ended up submitting his request for correction to NIST, they made no mention of molten metal or thermite in their request for correction. And here is the video with regards to the shooting at his school. So there was a real intimidation coming towards that. Now, the main thing that people also ended up doing is giving her a lot of flack. And there's a gentleman, Alan Savory, that made a very good statement with regards to the issues that we've got in peer review. And that's also been highlighted now on how corrupt the peer review system is. But this is also a very good thought experiment for people just to keep in mind with the debunking wars that we had around 9/11.
People talk glibly about science. What is science? People coming out of a university with a master's degree or a PhD, you take them into the field and they literally don't believe anything unless it's a peer-reviewed paper. It's the only thing they accept. And you say to them, but let's observe, let's think, let's discuss. They don't do it. It's just, is it in a peer-reviewed paper or not? That's their view of science. I think it's pathetic. Gone into universities as bright young people. They come out of them brain dead, not even knowing what science means. They think it means peer-reviewed papers, etc. No, that's academia. And if a paper is peer-reviewed, it means everybody thought the same, therefore they approved it. An unintended consequence is that when new knowledge emerges, new scientific insights, they can never, ever be peer-reviewed. So we're blocking all new advances in science that are big advances. If you look at the breakthroughs in science, almost always they don't come from the center of that profession. They come from the fringe. The finest candle makers in the world couldn't even think of electric lights. They don't come from within. They often come from outside the breaks. We're going to kill ourselves because of stupidity.
Now let's get into the major evidence. Okay, so were the towers destroyed by gravity collapse, thermite, explosives, or nukes? The answer is no for all of them, because the problem is not a shortage of evidence. The problem is nobody wants to look at the evidence and think for themselves. Instead, everybody wants to be told what to think by the experts in the mainstream media, alternative media, scientific community, government, and truth movement.
Like me wearing that blue shirt, entering a stadium full of people wearing a green, red, and white shirt. Do you feel like that, isolated, because there are so many other planted stories? Do you feel like the outsider?
Somewhat. I realize this is what the game is. We have, the hall monitor who guards door number one and sends them into door number two if they come out, the lie behind door number two and so forth. And they're always keeping them occupied. So any door is good as long as it isn't the evidence. So all of them are united in trashing me because I only present evidence. I don't present any theories, but they call it a theory so they can discount it to keep people from looking at it, because the objective is to keep people in this false choice dilemma. And I've got an example I give, as an analogy. If you get 1 plus 3 plus 9 plus 6 plus 4 plus 7 plus 2 plus 3 plus 9 plus 5 plus 8 equals 57. Is 57 a theory? I'm asking you.
No, it's fact.
Is it an opinion?
No.
Is it a view?
Well, first of all, I couldn't add all those numbers in my head, so I'm trusting that 57 is the right number. But if I were to get a calculator and the answer was 57, then it's fact.
Good answer. Is it a view?
No.
Is it a thesis?
No.
Speculation?
No.
Or is it a conclusion based on the sum of the information given?
The latter.
Okay. Now, could you arrive at the same number, 57, if you omitted all but the last two numbers, you know, 5 plus 8?
No.
Bingo. So how can someone come up with what happened if they eliminate almost all of the evidence?
Okay. This was in 2011. Okay. And people, we'll go into a second video in a short while where Gage actually confirms that he owns the book.
I studied at the University of Illinois, got a bachelor's degree in biology. Basically, I supported this organization and I'm a big fan of it, but I found out there was all this evidence that you weren't talking about. There's evidence such as the New York City seismographic data, the University of Alaska magnetometer data, the New York Police Department forensic study that found only one file cabinet of the thousands. The rest of them were missing. And the one remaining file cabinet showed severe metal distortion, almost like it had been warped in some way. The undamaged bathtub beneath World Trade Center, the trains that were down there, the PATH trains, all this information that's easily verifiable. And I was wondering why you weren't talking about it. And I was really concerned. And I only mentioned a couple of things. There are hundreds and hundreds of things. And so I wanted to message you and see if you had heard of them. And because the scientist that found all this information is also a scientist like you, her name is Dr. Judy Wood. She's a PhD scientist, got her degree in materials science engineering from Virginia Polytechnic Institute. I thought you would really want to know about this. So
yeah, this is really important. So let me address the issue.
My question.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, basically, I found out that she took legal action too.
What's
with all this information. So I sent you the question in an email if you had heard about any of this evidence and why you weren't talking
about it.
But you banned me from your petition. You never responded to my email.
Oh,
I silently.
What's your name again?
Abraham Davis Rodriguez.
Oh, hi, Abraham.
I was silently banned.
What's the question now, and I'll answer it.
Okay. Well, basically, because I was silently banned from your petition for that one email, never heard back from you, my question is kind of it's 4-in-1. So, Mr. Gates, why don't you mention any of the large sum of very important empirical evidence from 9/11 on your website or in the presentations?
Let's take it one at a time. Let's start with that one, okay?
Sure.
I'm not trying to cut you off. I'm trying to give them the information I think they need, which is a clear, honest response to your questions. There's a whole lot of evidence and very weird things that happen at the World Trade Center. Okay, there are about 10,000 file cabinets that are missing. There's about 20,000 floor trusses and 220 acres of metal decking that's missing. The question is, where did it go? Some people believe that there's an incredibly fine distribution of explosives that would be responsible for the turning into small metal filings, which we find in the World Trade Center dust, small metal filings, which could account for the file cabinets, the 220 acres of metal decking. And so that's one possibility. Others have posited other possibilities, such as what Abraham was talking about with advanced weapons.
I didn't say anything of the sort.
But it's a possibility that Judy Woods is advanced, so I'm just mentioning. Is that okay?
Sure,
just a minute.
Yeah, that's fine.
It's because it's important to respond to. Now, we don't know much about weapons that we don't know much about, right?
That isn't a normal explosions by bombs or anything like that. And the lack of the rubble pile and the people that survived. And if you look at what Building 6 looks like afterwards, you can see that was an empty hole. All that major building just disappeared. And you can see that even when you look at the rubble pile, there was intact core columns all over the shell. So they weren't crushed from weight coming from above. And again, that's a rumbling. That's not explosions, babe.
This huge incredible force of wind and debris actually came up the stairs.
That feeling of just riding the air.
Very, very fierce wind, and my heart started lifting me up off the ground.
So this over here is going to be the toasted car park. Now, something that Richard Gage also basically says is, okay, fine, there was these molten iron spheres that came over that was in this hot dust cloud that toasted up all the cars and everything, but you had people that were caught in that dust cloud. They didn't burn. There are other videos where you can basically look at a street full of cars that are half burned. Some are upturned, some are not. But in the same street, you can see that there are flagpoles with the flags that aren't burned either. So something else was going on there that affected those vehicles. And there's actually EMT witnesses that mentioned that they saw cars exploding and catching fire even before the buildings started to disintegrate. So you can see that's World Trade Center 2 turning into dust, no leaves catching fire. You can even see some of the paper in the middle of the dust cloud as well. And as soon as that dust has come over, you can see that Embassy Suites, that is what they call is the toasted car park. So those cars weren't towed anywhere. That's before, that's after. So what caused those vehicles to turn into shells, but you've got paper all over the shell that's not burned, you've got trees that aren't burned, the people didn't get burned, and that relates back to a experiment that John Hutchinson did when he was trying to replicate the Philadelphia experiment with a little boat. And as soon as he switched it off his gizmo, you had a car, the side of the metal boat having these weird fires just start. And now we've got World Trade Center 6 in the background. We're going to go closer now to see what that looks like, because these are cars that are, you've got World Trade Center 6 on the left-hand side, on the right-hand side where you've got the dust plume. That's where World Trade Center was. But there's no burnt paper here. The cars aren't burnt. So you can't make the claim that the whole dust cloud was full of molten micro spheres that caused all these vehicles to start burning if you can see cars right there that's got nothing wrong with it. So that completely debunks Richard Gage's talking point. And again, you've got the toasted car park with these cars catching fire, but other cars a little bit further away, there's nothing wrong with it. So that already tells you that you can't assert that it was something in the dust that caused all those vehicles to start burning. So there's something else going on. Again, do you hear massive explosions going off? No, it's a rumbling. It's a building disintegrating on a molecular level, the molecules repelling one another. Something really weird that you cannot explain by thermal or kinetic mechanisms. It breaks people's minds because this is sci-fi. We were watching a live sci-fi movie in real time. When they were in the middle of that building and they were fine, they walked out. The 9/11 surfer was back home with his pregnant wife 8 o'clock that evening. He only suffered a broken ankle. I hope I live. It's coming down on me. Here it comes. So again, this guy is less than a block away. And you'll see when he gets up now, after darkness goes away, that the cars around him are fine. There's a bunch of unburned paper. He is fine. He didn't get burned.
I'm sorry I came down. I just had to help you, but I should have known a second moment ago. My God. It is black as night on an outside and broad daylight.
And that beeping sound
behind the car
is the fireman's locator alarm. So what they had is you had a bunch of firemen that disappeared and they only found the fire alarm. So you've got this gentleman here that's basically less than a block away from the towers when they disintegrated, with this whole cloud coming over him. You'll see when he starts walking around, there is no burnt cars around him, unburnt paper. He isn't burned. He's fine. And you hear a bunch of locator alarms of the firemen. As soon as a fireman goes and lay down, then these alarms go off. And what they mentioned is they found a whole bunch of these fire alarms. I think it's made of plastic or something. And they didn't find the firemen. The firemen were missing, but they found the locator alarms. And that doesn't get talked about often as well.
You okay, sir? Okay. There's all these noises. I don't know what it is. They say someone needs help.
Yeah, Mike! Mike!
Now with this, if you look at the picture, the one here at the bottom, I did a presentation once where I was refuting 10 points of Thermite against Dew. And you can find it on my Substack. It was a very long podcast, but I broke it up into the specific sections, like the rubble pile height, the toasted cars, and the various aspects. And when, from this angle, you can physically see when the building basically peeled like a banana, you could see the shadow of the inner core of the South Tower that was still standing, and you can basically see it drop down to the ground as it was basically fizzling into dust. So people just need to go check out that section, because it takes around about 20 minutes just to go through the various South and North Tower cores. But again, you're looking here at these buildings coming apart. It looks like explosions, but it's not kinetic because you don't hear any loud booms, and there's no explosives out there that you can get that don't make any sound. The same with thermite. So if those buildings had a couple of hundred tons of thermite in there to blast the steel apart, you would have two bloody fire sparklers going off in the middle of Manhattan. And that's the main problem that I had initially, because I never basically upscaled the thermite. It's good to see that they've got an experiment with a single steel beam that's being cut. But now take that beam and multiply it with that whole bloody building, and people don't do that calculation in their minds. You can actually slow down this video. You can find it on the internet, and you can see those steel pieces falling don't even hit the ground. And that's afterwards. Where's the rubble? And you can see in the background that World Trade Center 7 is still standing. So that was before 5:20. So it's not like they carted off the stuff to China. It's not there. That's a little bit closer to where the South Tower stood. And if you look at what it looks like before and after, there's no rubble there. And that's the Bankers Trust building. Why is all the marble gone? But you've got certain of the windows there, they double glazed, that only have holes in the outside of the double glazing, but the inside is fine. So there was even strange things happening to glass. You would also find some of the cars that all the glass was blown out. You've never seen anything like this before, and that's why you need to rethink. It's not you're not looking at a collapse. You're looking at a disintegration of a building. Go look for all the controlled demolitions out there, and you go find me one controlled demolition of a building that's 50 stories, 40 stories, 30 stories that does this. Solid. Was that a solid piece going down to the ground? If you look at the top with those steel beams coming down, they are, as they are falling, they're frothing into dust. So there are no weapons in the public domain which can produce the effects we've just seen. This includes weapons like thermite explosives, nukes, fires, hijacked planes, hammers, lasers, cannonballs, and welding torches. This means it must have been a weapon that's not in the public domain. The observable evidence shows some kind of non-thermal and non-kinetic energy being directed at the World Trade Center to destroy it. Therefore, the use of directed energy weapon is not a theory or speculation. It's the most scientifically accurate way of describing what we are seeing. Richard Gage is disingenuous when he says, we don't know much about the weapon used on 9/11. There, we saw it in action, people. We don't know what a gun was, what information would be the most useful to figure out what kind of weapon it was. It's observable effects on people and objects. So, Mr. Gage, would really like to have a conversation with you, but unfortunately that is something that's impossible. But luckily in 2023, a lady with the name of Elsa Schroeder ended up hosting a truth summit, and she actually had a whole panel. The lady at the bottom worked for FEMA on 9/11, but let's listen to the first time that Andrew Johnson and Richard Gage actually squared off face to face.
What Mr. Gage has been saying, the answers to all of his points really are in the book Where Did the Towers Go by Dr. Judy Wood. And I know that Mr. Gage has a copy of that book. And if anybody wants to find out about that, that's on my website, checktheevidence.com, and they can write to me there. And I really think this is a very important issue. Some people say the details of 9/11 don't matter. Well, they do. And the way that those details are being covered up with layers and well-funded groups, it's very important that people understand that, because there are those layers operating elsewhere. So it may be you think you found the truth, but actually there is another layer in the way, and we have smooth operators trying to convince you of certain things using a certain vocabulary and certain things like neuro-linguistic programming and various techniques like that, which we see in advertising, to try and advertise these things to you. So I'd just like to make people aware of that. And that's been my experience quite markedly. And I've seen it in operation. I've seen it with people I know. I've seen them sort of stab me in the back intellectually, not physically, thankfully. So this is all documented in my books. And the people that want to read those are all free. So, you know, I'm not making any money off this. I don't get paid to do this. I work for the Open University still. They did want to get rid of me. But that was after they published one of my articles back in 2007, thankfully. You know, all those tactics, I'm sure, are familiar to many of the panelists here. There are well-funded groups trying to cover up obvious evidence and masquerade, put other things forward as which masquerade as evidence, but actually they're not.
Andrew and Judy have evidence that you are not paying attention to, because I have been reading the book.
Oh, I read the book too. Yeah.
You read the book too. Okay.
Yeah,
so there.
I found it to be almost pure fantasy.
Okay. Actually. There was absolutely no. Okay. So I'm not going to get into the discussion then. What my fantasy was, you're publicizing your ability to push it out combined with the directed energy stuff, because the directed energy weapons, these definitely exist.
If I may interject here, Elsa.
Of course.
The evidence for the forest fires is very peculiar, but it's not as well documented as what happened on 9/11. In Dr. Judy Wood's book, you'll see the results of surveys of 40,000 pictures, a survey of 500 witness accounts of the day. Also, you'll see that these directed energy weapons are not like anything that you see advertised by the military, such as the airborne laser or anything like that. These are completely different class of technology, which is completely in the black world. And that's how I came to understand it, because I investigated the UFO cover-up, which is also involves the black world, which is not spoken about. People don't know about it. A lot of that stuff goes back to Los Alamos National Laboratories, for example. And then you have figures like Colonel John Alexander, who worked for them and went to see John Hutchison in 1983. So this technology, this black technology, has a history which is decades old and probably goes back to the 1940s. This is not a fantasy. This is not what is Dr. Wood's book is not a fantasy, and she's not a witch, which is what Mr. Gage has called her in the past.
I didn't call her a witch.
I've got a recording of you saying that, sir. So
I'm afraid
you did. That's what you implied. That's what you implied. You didn't call her a witch, but you said that if she's writing a book like that, she's practicing witchcraft. A recording of you saying that, you did. It's on my website.
Okay. Have you examined all of the other? She is extremely highly qualified, which you are not, as a structural physicist, interferometry, to do a complete. She's got the only one out there. She's put her name on the dotted line, to file a case on it, a QI-TAM case, a whistleblower, which I can't believe that you admit you don't know. But let's say you don't.
There are dozens of nuts out there with PhDs, Ralph.
Let's not make
wait a minute. Whoa. Are you calling Dr. Judy Williams? Wait a minute.
I says there are dozens of nuts out there
that's
PhD.
Not appropriate to our conversation. Our conversation is
you're making
have
an
you
argument,
examined and
you're
taken on her book, which
you're
she has documented to a great degree. Have you read her book, and are you willing to debunk it, all of these different phenomena? Have you done that, or are you going to do that?
Now, with Judy Woods is not going to acknowledge any of that evidence and just hand wave it away, then she's not practicing science. She's practicing witchcraft.
A quick summary is that the buildings didn't burn up, nor did they slam to the ground, but they turned into dust in midair. How do I know that? Because if they had collapsed to the ground, you'd have a pile of debris that would correspond to 210-story buildings. That didn't happen. Lower Manhattan would have been flooded due to a broken bathtub, the dike that holds out the Hudson River. Few people realize that the towers were built in the Hudson River. And you know, the bedrock is 70 feet below the water table. So there's this dike, they call the bathtub or slurry wall, that holds out the Hudson River. If you crash down two 500,000-ton buildings onto the bathtub, it would have ruptured and flooded the subway tunnels, the PATH train tunnels. That didn't happen. As a matter of fact, when they took down the remains of Building 6, they used a cable to pull it down because they were afraid to use explosives. And this was a six-story building.
Mm-hmm.
It was just this little clump left. And the other way I know that it wasn't that buildings turned to dust, just the simple way, is that if the buildings had collapsed to the ground, they'd make a thud, and the seismic signal that was recorded did not correspond to the size of the buildings. The seismic signal corresponded to a 16-story building or a 20-story building, not 110-story buildings.
Okay, so I went onto another podcast a while ago where I spoke to a gentleman from the UK with a Pirate Truth podcast, and this gentleman had Richard Gage on. I mentioned to him that there's some things that Richard isn't discussing, and this is the what he had to say.
Well, I mean, before I sort of came across you, and I came across you after posting on Twitter about my interview with Richard Gage, and you kind of interacted with that post. Before that time, I had never heard this narrative at all, in conspiracy kind of circles, anywhere at all. And I'd just like to say that, you know, this has been a very nice long form podcast where you've presented, you know, a heck of a lot of information. And I've got to be honest, man, this to me, and again, doing what we are kind of asking our audience to do here is keep an open mind and being able to be presented with evidence and not necessarily, you know, take it in or throw it away. Just be able to hold that information. And I'm trying to, as you're talking, as you're kind of giving me this evidence that you've got, I'm trying to weigh it up in my mind's eye with what Richard Gage also presented in a very, you know, kind of professional way and all that kind of stuff. And I've got to be honest, the way that if you just watch what happened, particularly the thing that stuck out to me was watching those steel beams as they were collapsing and turning to dust. If you literally just look at physically watch the buildings collapse or watch the buildings disintegrate
on a molecular level.
Yeah, it makes more sense, even though the idea of it is way more far out, because we're led to believe, like you said, we're led to believe that it's pure science fiction. Whereas thermite and explosives, we all know that stuff exists. We all know that it can be used and all that kind of stuff, but it doesn't actually fit what you watch when you actually, you know, when you take the narratives away from your mind and you just look at the events taking place. It certainly fits better with that. So I want to thank you for countering when I was kind of promoting that Richard Gage episode.
So just as hazardous and wasteful technology behind a nuclear bomb can also be used to provide hazardous and wasteful nuclear power, the technology that was used to for the clean and effortless molecular dissociation of the twin towers could also be used to give the whole world effortless clean energy. Exposing this clean free energy technology means an end to the ruling elite's ability to control and exploit the general population through scarce, expensive, dirty, and inefficient resources such as oil, coal, nuclear, and renewables. Any group with an interest in maintaining the current paradigm of artificial scarcity and crappy energy technologies which keeps the general population enslaved would have an interest in helping to maintain the 9/11 cover-up, because exposing the crime also exposes the technology used to commit it. And just to put in the last little word here from Arthur C. Clarke, any sufficient advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. By using a technology which was beyond the general public's knowledge and comprehension, the perpetrators hope to be able to commit their crime in broad daylight with impunity. The crime committed on 9/11 can't even be defined using the tightly controlled science taught in schools and universities, and current laws do not cover acts of magic. And currently, this is what DARPA's been working on, global laser beam wireless energy transfer network to provide near uninterruptible power supply to the U.S. forces worldwide. So why can't we have free energy? Why can only the U.S. military be privy to such things? And just to circle back to another researcher that also came to the same conclusion, that some sort of cold fusion was in play, is Bob Greenier. He's from the Martin Fleischmann Project, and he's been doing a lot of research on exotic vacuum objects, EVOs, low energy nuclear reactions, which you can call Lehner or cold fusion, and also the Hutchinson effect. He's got over, I think, 300 videos where he's done the metal samples of a Hutchinson effect, which has similarities to what we saw on 9/11. And this is just a quick discussion where he is just going to give you a bit of an idea of how he came to the same conclusion as Dr. Wood, but from a completely different field. I do apologize for the podcaster who's got a little bit of a crazy screen, so, but it gets better after a while.
From 9/11 Revisionist, asking if you've read Dr. Judy Wood's book and if you have an opinion on that. And after that,
well, Judy Wood does not have a theory. She just looks at the evidence. And yes, I have the book. I've read it. I've actually spoken to Dr. Judy Wood. I think she was a very brave individual. My journey with understanding aspects of this technology came because I started from cold fusion. Mm-hmm. And after 4 years, I realized it was explained by John Hutchison, Ken Shoulders, and that all together they explained 9/11, right? And I was about to go and present to the Indian Nuclear Authority on how to use how to do low energy nuclear reactions and enhanced reaction in a nickel hydrogen system. And I was presenting at the IIT Mumbai to, I think, seven students about the former lead of cold fusion research at Barbara Atomic Research Center, Mahadevan Srinivasan, sadly departed, and some current people, I think, and some private entity. And there was one individual that came there, Suhas Ralkar. And that's how I ended up going to visit Suhas Ralkar's lab and take the videos that precisely led me down the journey to look at this as hydrodynamic and then magnetohydrodynamic process. And I got up and I spoke for about the first 2 hours on ball lightning. And then I explained that I believed that this did the twin towers. And what happened was that 3 days before I was going, I realized, because I'd spent October in Hungary videoing Dr. George Ege, one of the world's experts in ball lightning. I did a series of videos you can see on a channel called Stardust. There's a three-part series. It's translated into German as well, if there's native Germans there. And basically, George was describing these ball lightnings going through a window and leaving a hole, a round hole. So I just thought, okay, I see these. As I told you, we burnt cars and mobile homes at the beginning. because we had them on our caravan site. People would just leave them there, and we just had fun with them, me and my three brothers. And then we would take the burnt out shells to the scrap heap on the back of the trailer. It was, you know, what boys, what you can do. But I have burnt a lot of cars, or several cars, with petrol, or my brothers have, or bombs. And I never saw the steel melt. But when I was thinking about this in my head, did this do 9/11? Oh, and I remember from those days seeing these cars with these folded down bits of metal. I thought, that's very weird. And I tried to look for those. And I found all these cars on Federal D Roosevelt Drive, which had, you know, part of it not touched at all, another part where it was like folded down, like it turned to jelly. And I'm thinking, that's just not possible, right? Because I know how cars burn, and it does not burn like that, right? So then I thought, well, I'm a bit worried here, because I could go and make a presentation, and I'm saying it's ball lightning. And if this did 9/11, I said, all right, here's my watershed thing. I will type in ground zero, round holes, windows, but 9/11 or something like that. I typed in something like that, search into Google. It doesn't work, by the way, now, if you do it. I've said it so many times. And all these pictures came up of buildings around 9/11, the ground zero, where they had literally round holes in the windows. And I'm thinking, oh, shit, oh. And I swore to myself, and I thought, this is just, I can't believe this is happening. And down in the bottom of the image, I saw Dr. Judy Wood as a watermark. And I thought, who the hell is Dr. Judy Wood? So I went to a website, and it's like, 9/11, la 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 la. And I thought, yeah, well, she doesn't know it's John Hutchison. And then I find three pages of John Hutchison. I go, well, yeah, she doesn't know it's Ken Shoulders and Ball Lightning. And there's pages on Ken Shoulders. And I thought, she has come from what she observed as a structural engineer. And by 2007 or 2009, she had realized that 9/11 was done by what is done by the Hutchison effect. Although I believe firmly that this technology was developed in the 1960s, it's not John Hutchison's fault. It's not anything John Hutchison did that made this come into the fore. It was weaponized. Probably the understanding was understood in the early to mid 1950s, and it was weaponized by the early 1960s. So this is no fault of John Hutchison's whatsoever, right? And like I say, several other people have observed the jellification of metals, and it was turned into a technology in the Soviet Union, right, in the 1980s, so, or before, right? So both sides had it. So, but the point is that I'm thinking I was unique in this finding, cold fusion down to John Hutchison, Ken Shoulders, and Ball Lightning, and she'd come from 9/11, and this explained 9/11. She'd come from 9/11, and in fact, said that this was explained by John Hutchison, Ken Shoulders, and was Ball Lightning, and it's the same thing as cold fusion. So we came from completely opposite ends, and we met at exactly the same conclusions in all respects.
Yeah.
So I had a decision to make, and those were the three most traumatic days of my life by far. I had a decision. Do I walk about away from this field of research, which I've built a good reputation in, and just lie to myself that I don't know what I know? Or do I say what I know and just let the chips fall where they may? And I decided on the latter, to keep my integrity. I thought, I'm literally nothing if I cannot be honest of something that's literally changed the lives of most people on the planet.
Norman, thank you very much. It was an extensive, shall we say, presentation.
Yeah.
Lots to think about.
It's easier for people who haven't been corrupted by the 9/11 truth movement or other theories or whatever. So it's very difficult for people to break free from preconceived notions. And that's something that I had to do. And I've been challenged by a lot of people saying, no, but it's nukes, no, it's that. Then you go back and you go work through everything. And then you can see that if you actually look at the whole body of evidence, there's nothing else that explains it. Now, the first thing that people would ask you is, where was it? What's the power source? What? But that's what Dr. Wood did in a court case. Is she went after the guys who would know, and that's the guys who are in the Directed Energy Professional Society, and that's ARA and SIAC. Those guys were tasked with the security and cleanup of Ground Zero. They wrote the forgery and NIST reports that made up the 10,000-page NIST report. Even Boeing was involved. So there's a cover-up within a cover-up within a cover-up, and that's what Andrew Johnson also discussed with you on your radio show. So hopefully this is enough to have people just reassess and actually just go look at some of Dr. Wood's presentations. She had a great interview with you. Then again, Mark Conlon on the planes, Adam Eisenberg with regards to the Pentagon, and then Andrew Johnson's two books where he chronicles the whole truther movement and everything around that. The information is there, but people just need to go have a look.
How can I follow your work?
Well, I'm on X and then my Substack. But once again, I don't really need followers. I don't want followers. I just want people to go look at Dr. Wood's book and Andrew Johnson's two books, and they can then make up their own minds. I'm just a local guy who's done a little bit of my due diligence, and once you just break free from your preconceived ideas of what you should have about 9/11, hopefully you'll get to the truth as well. How strange and weird it is, because sometimes life is stranger than science fiction.
9/11 revisionist, aka Norman, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thanks, Jerm. Very nice chatting with you.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please visit supportjerm.com.